All right, could everyone take their seats, please? We're about to begin. Let me welcome all of you to this event this afternoon. This is the first of a series of public lectures, hopefully on an annual basis, that's arranged by the Cold War Studies Program within the International History Department here at the LSC. The purpose of these lectures is to invite people who have served in high office to give some of their thoughts on what the future may look like. And I think in Mr. McNamara's case, what the future ought to look like and should look like, based on the experiences they've drawn during their years in high office. It's a particular pleasure for me to welcome Ms. Robert McNamara and Professor Robert Brigham. Mr. McNamara, as all of you will know, served during the Kennedy and the Johnson administrations as Secretary of Defense. Later on, he went on to head the World Bank from 1968 until he retired in 1981. Ms. McNamara is born in 1916. He graduated from the University of California in 1937, also studied at Harvard, and taught at Harvard for a period before he was commissioned to the Air Force during the Second World War, where he served in the UK, in India, and in China, and in the Pacific, before he went on in active duty as a lieutenant colonel in April of 1946. He also served as director and as president of the Ford Motor Company before President Kennedy asked him to serve as the Secretary of Defense, a position he then held from 1961 until 1968. Mr. McNamara, as you will know, is someone who has not only held high office, but also someone who has been willing to discuss and to think about the lessons that he learned during those periods in office after he retired. He has written and spoken on a great number of topics, including population and development, world hunger, which I think is one of his particular preoccupations in the beginning of this century, on environmental issues, on East-West relations, on nuclear arms, and of course, his vision for the world at the beginning of the 21st century. Professor Brigham is the Shirley Ecker Boskie Professor of History at Vassar College. Professor Brigham has worked particularly on the history of the Vietnam War, or Vietnam Wars, I should say. His most well-known book is called Guerrilla Diplomacy, the NLF's Foreign Relations and the Vietnam War. But he's also been working very closely with Mr. McNamara on a number of conferences and seminars to draw out some of the lessons of the Vietnam War, lessons that, it should be said, were not learned at the time, and how these can be applied to the future. It's a great pleasure for me to welcome both of you here to the LSE today. I have been very fortunate in participating in a number of the events that Mr. McNamara has organized on lessons from the Vietnam War. We have not always agreed, but I have been consistently impressed with the openness and the generosity and the persistence of his search for the lessons that can be learned that would have a particular impact for the future of his country and the future of the world. Mr. McNamara, please.
Thank you very much, Arne. Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. This is not my first appearance at LSE, and I'm delighted to be back. Now, I want to begin my remarks this afternoon by telling you of my earliest memories as a child. My earliest memory is of a city exploding with joy. The city was San Francisco. The date was November 11, 1918, Armistice Day. I was 2 years old. The city, of course, was celebrating the end of World War I, but it was not celebrating not only that victory, but the belief of many Americans, and particularly of President Wilson, our president at the time, that we and our allies had won a war to end all wars. They were wrong, of course. The 20th century was on its way to becoming the bloodiest in all of human history. And during it, something on the order of 160 million people were killed by conflicts, conflicts within nations and conflicts across the globe. And were similar conflicts to occur in this century, when population will have risen threefold, and when wars are likely to be fought with weapons of mass destruction, the fatalities, of course, would be substantially higher. I don't know what, say 300 million. Now, is that what we want from the first century of the new millennium? I hope not. And if not, the time to think about the problem and initiate action to prevent it is now. And I believe we should begin by establishing a realistic appraisal of the problem. It's very complex and very dangerous, more complex and more dangerous than I think most of us understand. The Carnegie Endowment established a commission known as the Carnegie Commission. It was chaired by the former U.S. Secretary of State, Cy Vance, and by David Hamburg, the chairman of the Carnegie Endowment. One of the members of that commission was your own ex-foreign minister, David Owen. And that commission said this, and I'm going to quote from their report: "Peace will require greater understanding and respect for differences within and across national boundaries. We humans do not have the luxury any longer of indulging our our prejudices and ethnocentrism. They're anachronisms of our ancient past. The worldwide historical record is full of hateful, destructive behavior based on religious, racial, political, ideological, and other distinctions, holy wars of one sort or another. Will such behavior in the next century be expressed with weapons of mass destruction? If we cannot learn to accommodate each other respectfully in the 21st century, we can destroy each other at such a rate that humanity will have little to cherish." That was the statement of the Carnegie Commission. It's a statement I very much agree with. They were saying, in effect, that the end of the Cold War in 1989 did not and will not in and of itself result in an end of conflict. And I think we see the evidence of that truth on all sides every day. The Iraqi invasion of Kuwait, the civil war in Yugoslavia, the tension between India and Pakistan, the unstable relations in the Middle East, the conflict across sub-Saharan Africa. These all make clear that the world of the future will not be without conflict. Conflict between disparate groups within nations and conflict extending across national borders. Racial, religious, ethnic tensions will remain. Nationalism will be a powerful force across the globe. Political revolutions will erupt as societies advance. Historic disputes over boundaries will endure. And economic disparities within and among nations will increase as technology and education spread unevenly around the world. The underlying causes of conflict that existed long before the Cold War began remain now that it's ended. And it's just such causes of conflict that in the past 50 years have contributed to about 125 wars causing 40 million deaths. So in these respects, the world of the future will not be different from the world of the past. Conflicts within nations, conflicts among nations will not disappear. In relation to the new century, I believe the conflicts of the past 100 years have two fundamental messages for us. And these may be among the most contentious statements I make today. These messages can be conveyed in the form of two imperatives, which I think should shape the U.S. foreign policy and indeed the foreign policies of other major nations across the globe. And these two imperatives are these. First, the moral imperative. I believe we should establish as a major goal of U.S. foreign and defense policy, and indeed of foreign policies across the globe, as a major goal of U.S. and other foreign policies, the avoidance in this century of the carnage, 160 million dead, killed by conflict in the 20th century. The second imperative is even more contentious. I believe that politically, economically, militarily, the U.S. is today and will remain for as far ahead as I can see, several decades at a minimum, by far the most powerful nation in the world, politically, economically, and militarily. But I believe that we should never utilize that power other than in a multilateral context. Now, many say when they're talking about the U.S., that we're isolationist or hegemonistic. I don't think either one of those labels is correct. I would term us unilateralist, arrogantly unilateralist. Now, in contrast to that, as I say, I believe we should never, with the minor qualification of an attack on continental U.S. or Alaska and Hawaii, we should never utilize our economic, political, or military superior power other than in the context of multilateral decision-making. A multilateral decision-making process. Now, before turning to what that process might be, I want to talk briefly about relations among nations in this century. I think among political theorists, this is quite a controversial topic. Those who are classified as realists, and I believe that, as I understand it, is the majority, those political theorists classified as realists predict a return to traditional power politics. And they argue that the disappearance of ideological competition between East and West will trigger a reversion to traditional relationships based on territorial and economic imperatives. And they say that the United States, Russia, Western Europe, China, Japan, perhaps India, will seek to assert themselves in their own regions while still competing for dominance in other areas of the world where conditions are fluid. And this realist view has been expressed most notably perhaps by Professor Michael Sandel of Harvard, and he's written, and I quote his words, "The end of the Cold War does not mean an end of global competition between the superpowers. Once the ideological dimension fades, what you're left with is not peace and harmony, but old-fashioned global politics based on dominant powers competing for influence and pursuing their internal interests." Henry Kissinger, an old friend of mine, is also a member of the realist school. We couldn't disagree more than on this particular point. And he's expressed a conclusion very similar to that I read from Michael Sandel's words. And Kissinger's written, "Victory in the Cold War has propelled America into a world which bears many similarities to the European state system of the 18th and 19th centuries. The absence of an overriding ideological or strategic threat frees nations to pursue foreign policies based increasingly on their immediate national interest. In an international system characterized by perhaps five or six major powers and a multiplicity of smaller states, order will have to emerge, much as it did in past centuries, from a reconciliation and balancing of competing national interests." Now, in contrast to Sandel and Kissinger, Carl Kazin, who is the former director of the Institute of Advanced Studies at Princeton, Carl Kazin has written this, and I quote Carl. He said, "The international system that relies on the national use of military force as the ultimate guarantor of security and the threat of its use as the basis of order is not the only possible one. To seek a different system is no longer the pursuit of an illusion, but a necessary effort toward a necessary goal." I very, very much agree with Kazin. Kissinger's and Sandel's conception of relations among nations in this post-Cold War world are, of course, well-founded historically. But I would argue they're inconsistent with our increasingly interdependent world. No nation, not even the United States, as powerful as it is, no nation can stand alone in a world in which nations are as inextricably intertwined with one another, economically, environmentally, politically, and with regard to security. So I believe that for the future, the United Nations Charter offers a far more appropriate framework for the international relations than does Sandel's and Kissinger's doctrine of power politics. I would also argue that their emphasis on the balance of power politics in the 21st century assumes we'll be willing to continue to accept a foreign policy which lacks a strong moral foundation. I'm quite aware that the majority of political scientists, particularly those who are members of the realist school, believe morality, as contrasted to a careful calculation of national interests based on balance of power considerations, morality is a dangerous guide for establishment of foreign policy. And they would say, and I think with some justification, that a foreign policy based on moral considerations promotes zealousness and a crusading spirit with potentially dangerous results. But surely, in the most basic sense, one can apply a moral judgment to the level of killing which occurred in the 20th century. There can be no justification for it, no moral justification for it. Nor can there be any justification for its continuation into this century. So on moral grounds alone, I believe we should act today to prevent such an outcome. A first step would be to establish such a moral imperative as the primary foreign policy goal for our nation and for the entire human race. We're far from accepting that objective. Now, if we're to achieve that objective, if we're to avoid in the 21st century the tragic loss of life we lived through, above all else, special emphasis must be placed on avoiding conflict among the great powers. We have made some progress in that direction, but we have a long way to go. Excluding the end of the Cold War, I believe the two most important geopolitical events of the past 50 years have been the reconciliation between France and Germany after hundreds of years of enmity, and the establishment of peaceful relations between Japan and the U.S. after one of the bloodiest conflicts in the modern era. I doubt that many of you know how bloody the war between U.S. and Japan was. I was talking to a U.S. audience the other day, and I happened to mention that in March of 1945, I was out on the island of Guam on temporary duty with the 20th Bomber Command, command of B-29s that I'd served with from its inception. And I was there on Guam on temporary duty in March of 1945. On one night, General LeMay, who was commander, and I sat together and we interrogated the lead crews of a B-29 bombing mission of the 20th Bomber Command against Tokyo. And in that single night, we burned to death 100,000 Japanese civilians. And we went on to carry out 66 other bombing raids of that kind. Not everyone of them burned to death, 100,000, were that many Japanese there. But that point is not at all understood in the U.S. today. We do not understand how violent these conflicts were of the 20th century. So as I say, I think the two most important geopolitical events of the past half century have been the reconciliation between France and Germany and the U.S. and Japan. It is inconceivable today that either Germany or Japan would engage in a war with any of the great powers of the Western world. Now, can't we move to integrate both Russia and China into the family of nations in ways that make war between them and the other great powers equally unlikely? We've begun to do so, but much, much more is necessary. We've made, I think, rather substantial progress in integrating Russia into relations, particularly with Europe, but more generally with the U.S. and Japan, in ways that reduce the risk of war between the great powers, Russia and Europe, or Russia and Japan, or Russia and the U.S. But much, much more is required, particularly with respect to China. For example, today, no senior military official is allowed to meet with his Chinese counterpart. And that's true at a time when the Chinese are rapidly expanding their military budget. I don't suggest they're expanding it because of aggressive intentions. But the fact is, they're vastly expanding that budget, and they're going to continue to do so, and they're building a projectable military power. That's something we should be concerned about. I'm not describing aggressive tendencies of them, but is just a force in the world we should think about and relate to, and I don't think we in the U.S. have done nearly enough about it. And this rapid expansion of military power is occurring when Taiwan remains a flashpoint between China and the U.S. Now, I turn now to a second issue that I think we must address if we're to avoid in this century the loss of life, loss of human life due to conflict that we saw in the 20th century. And that subject is nuclear weapons. Immediate action by you, Britain, and we in the U.S. is needed if we're to avoid the further proliferation of these weapons and the risk of their accidental or inadvertent use leading to destruction of nations in the event that wars among nations of the kind we saw in the 20th century continue into the 21st. I doubt that many in the room realize that today, 12 years after the end of the Cold War, as we sit here, the U.S. has something on the order of 7,000 strategic offensive nuclear warheads, each one of which has, on average, 30 times the destructive power of the Hiroshima bomb. The U.S. has 7,000 strategic offensive nuclear warheads deployed, directed at Russia. And Russia has something in the order of 6,000 directed at the U.S. In total, they have a destructive power, if you can imagine this, 300,000 times that of the Hiroshima bomb, which killed something on the order of 100,000 people. It's insane, absolutely insane. And I want to spend a few minutes talking about that. We in the U.S. and all other inhabitants of the globe, because nuclear war could not be limited to the belligerent powers, we in the U.S. and all other inhabitants of our globe continue to live with the risk of nuclear escalation, nuclear destruction. The U.S. and NATO's war plans today, your war plans in a sense as a member of NATO, provide for contingent use of nuclear weapons just as they did when I became Secretary of Defense 40 years ago. But I don't believe the average American or the average Briton recognizes that fact. Certainly I can speak for Americans. I know they don't recognize it. And no doubt the average American or the average Briton was surprised and pleased when the series of arms control agreements that were negotiated in the 1990s became apparent. You may remember that the initial arms control agreements were designed to bring the offensive forces of the U.S. and Russia down from a total strategic offensive force of something in the order of 20,000 warheads down to 13,000. And then START II, negotiated a couple of years after that, was to reduce that total of 13,000 down to 10,000. And in March of 1997, Presidents Clinton and Yeltsin spoke of taking the total of 10,000 down to 11,000 and 6,000. That compares with the 13,000 we have today. But even if such a limit were to be approved by the U.S. Congress and the Russian Duma, and that's far from likely, the risk of destruction of societies across the globe, while somewhat reduced, would be far from eliminated. So the question is, can't we go further? And surely the answer must be yes. The question, I think, points to both the opportunity and the urgency with which the world should re-examine the possession of nuclear weapons by other nations. And I think we should begin with a broad public debate. We haven't had it in the U.S. I don't think you've had it in Britain. If you had, I was unaware of it. And I think such a debate should open with a discussion of the moral issues relating to the use of nuclear weapons. There's a very, very fundamental moral issue here. I've said that most political scientists, most security experts, oppose introducing moral considerations into discussions of international relations and defense policy. And I do know, as I've said, that in many situations they provide at best ambiguous guidance to what should be done. But surely the five declared nuclear powers should be prepared to accept that it would be totally immoral for any one of them, no matter what the provocation, to believe that it, through its leader, acting alone, has the right to initiate action that will destroy another nation. And it would be even more morally unacceptable if that action by one belligerent, one leader, should destroy not only the other belligerent through the but non-belligerent nations through the spread of radioactivity as well. And yet that would have been the result of either Russia or the U.S. had implemented the nuclear strategy which each nation followed for 40 years and continues to follow today along with your own nation. After starting the debate with consideration of the moral question, then the debate should move on to more detailed considerations of the military utility of the weapons. Perhaps one could override moral considerations if there was tremendous military utility. But also should consider offsetting military risks of their use. And I think that debate on military utility and risk would support the conclusion that we would move back to a non-nuclear world, should move back to a non-nuclear world. On support, my position on these nuclear weapons, I want to make 3 points. First, I want to tell of the experience of the Cuban Missile Crisis in 1962, and in particular what we've learned about it recently. And I want to make clear that so long as we and other great powers possess large inventories of nuclear weapons, we will face the risk of their use, and we will face the risk of destruction of nations. The second point I want to make is that that risk, if it ever was justifiable on military grounds, is no longer justifiable. There is no military utility to nuclear weapons today other than to deter one's opponent from their use. And thirdly, I want to say that in recent years, there's been a dramatic change in the thinking of leading Western security experts, both military and civilian, regarding the military utility of these weapons. More and more of them, although certainly not yet a majority, but more and more of them are expressing views very similar to those I've expressed. First, let me deal very quickly with the Cuban Missile Crisis. I think it's now widely recognized that the actions of the U.S., Cuban, and Russia, Soviet Union, in October 1962 brought the three nations to the verge of war. But what wasn't known then, and is not widely understood today, was how close the world came to the brink of nuclear disaster. Some 6 years ago, the Kennedy Library released heretofore highly classified tapes, which provided new insights into the near catastrophe from a U.S. point of view. And a few months before, a somewhat similar account had been published, A Khrushchev's State of Mind. Both accounts are frightening. Neither the Soviet Union nor the United States intended by its action to create the risks that they both incurred. I want to take a moment or two to remind you of what happened at the time. The crisis began when the Soviets began moving nuclear missiles and bombers to Cuba secretly and with a clear intent to deceive. This was part of the problem. In the summer and early fall of 1962, the missiles were to be targeted against cities along America's East Coast, putting 90 million Americans at risk. And photographs of the deployment of the Soviet missiles in Cuba came to President Kennedy's, and were taken by a U-2 aircraft on October 14, 1962, and came to President Kennedy's attention the day after that as a result. And Kennedy and his military and security advisors believed that the Soviet action posed a threat to the West, as did your prime minister at the time. And Kennedy therefore authorized a naval quarantine of Cuba to be effective on Wednesday, October 24th. Preparations also began for airstrikes and a land and sea invasion. The contingency plans for airstrikes called for the first day airstrike of 1080 sorties, a huge air attack, larger than any single day's attack in Kosovo. And an invasion force totaling 180,000 troops with supporting ships was assembled in southeast U.S. ports. And the crisis came to a head on Saturday, October 27, and Sunday, October 28. Had Khrushchev not publicly announced on that Sunday that he was removing the missiles, I believe that on Monday a majority of Kennedy's military and civilian advisors would have recommended the attacks. To understand what caused the crisis and how to avoid similar events in the future, high-ranking Soviet, Cuban, and American participants in the discussions leading up to the final crisis met for a series of meetings over a five-year period between 1987 and 1992. During the meetings, we considered the risks faced by each. The majority of President Kennedy's advisors, as I say, were prepared to recommend attack. At the time, the CIA said they believed there were no nuclear warheads on the island. The majority of Kennedy's advisors believed there would be no Soviet military response. At the time, the CIA reported there were some 10,000 Soviet troops on the island. We learned many, many years later there were 43,000 Soviet troops there and 270,000 well-armed Cubans who, in the words of their commanders, were determined to fight to the death. And their commanders said they expected to suffer 100,000 casualties. And the Soviets who were present at this meeting in Moscow, who included, among others, the Soviet foreign minister, Gromyko, and the Soviet ambassador to the U.S., Anatoly Dobrynin, expressed their utter disbelief that we, the senior advisors to Kennedy, could ever have thought, in the face of such a catastrophic defeat as they would have suffered by a U.S. attack on Cuba, that they would not have responded militarily someplace in the world. Now, in 1962, some of us, particularly President Kennedy and I, believed the U.S. faced great danger during that crisis. But later, we learned that both of us, and certainly our associates, had seriously underestimated those dangers. At a meeting in Havana, and that occurred in January 1992, that's 29 years after the crisis, we learned for the first time that, contrary to the CIA estimates, there were nuclear warheads on the island of Cuba on October 28, 1962. And subsequently, we learned that not only were there warheads for the strategic missiles there in Cuba, but there were tactical warheads as well. And the tactical warheads were to be used against U.S. invasion forces. At the time, as I say, in 1962, the CIA was reporting no nuclear warheads there. They said they thought the first batch of 20 was coming on a ship named the Voltava. In November 1992, some 10 months or so after the meeting with Castro in Havana, when we learned for the first time in January 92 of the nuclear warheads there for the offensive strategic weapons, we learned there were a total of 162 nuclear warheads on the soil of Cuba, 90 of which were to be used against an invasion force, and the other 70 to be used on the missiles targeted on U.S. cities. Moreover, it was reported in the Soviet press that on October 26, 1962, which was a Friday night, 2 days before the critical date of October 28, that the Soviet commander, Pliyev, in Cuba had ordered movement of the nuclear warheads from their storage sites to be closer to their launch vehicles. And he'd sent a cable informing Malinovsky, the Soviet defense minister, of that fact. And Malinovsky had sent it into Khrushchev, and Khrushchev sent it back to Malinovsky with approved scrawled across the document. So clearly there was a very, very high risk that in the face of a U.S. attack, which, as I say, the majority of Kennedy's military and civilian advisors were prepared to recommend, there was a very, very high risk that in the face of such an attack, the Soviet forces in Cuba would have decided to use their nuclear weapons instead of lose them. Now, we needn't speculate upon what would have happened in that case. Although a U.S. invasion force, the U.S. invasion force that I referred to, would not have been equipped with tactical nuclear weapons, they wouldn't have been equipped because when President Kennedy and I received a request from our commander to equip them, so the commander saying he had to be prepared to use them because he was sure the Soviets were there, and we told him he was crazy as hell. The Soviets didn't have them, and by God, he wasn't going to have them. So he didn't have them. The invasion force would not have had them. But no one should believe that had American troops been attacked with nuclear weapons, the U.S. would have refrained from a nuclear response. We would have sent fighter aircraft with nuclear weapons from some place in southeast U.S. Where would it have ended? In utter disaster. Not just for us, not just for the Soviet Union, for you. It would have been uncontrolled escalation, I'm sure. Now, the point I want to emphasize is this. Human beings are fallible. We know we all make mistakes. In our daily lives, mistakes are costly, but we try to learn from them. Conventional wisdom is don't make the same mistake twice. Well, maybe you're going to make it twice, three times, but don't make it four. Military operations, and this is something that you don't understand, except those of you who may have been military commanders. Military operations are much, much more complex than civilian operations. This is the meaning of the phrase fog of war. What it means is there are more variables in military operations than civilian operations. It's more difficult to predict the reaction of those variables to forces that react against them. So mistakes are much more likely. This happens all the time. Just last week, you may have read of the deaths that occurred due to, quote, friendly fire, unquote, in Afghanistan. All that means is we launched some U.S. weapons against, as it turned out, U.S. soldiers, and they were killed. Happens all the time. Against friendly forces or against enemy forces. Mistakes are common in conventional war. But the conventional women don't make the same mistakes. Learn from your mistakes. And we do. And the mistakes in conventional war with conventional weapons don't destroy nations. In nuclear war, there isn't going to be any learning period. You make one mistake, you're going to destroy nations. So I think the lesson of the Cuban Missile Crisis, the lesson of what I've said is, the indefinite combination of human fallibility and nuclear weapons carries a very high risk of potential nuclear catastrophe. And therefore, I think we must move to eliminate or near eliminate nuclear weapons. On the contrary, is there a military justification for continuing to accept the risk of the use, inadvertent risk or accidental use? And as I said, I think the answer is no. U.S. and NATO policy today is as it was essentially when I became secretary 40 years ago. We refused then, and we refuse today, to adopt a policy of what's known as no first use. That is to say, NATO will not use nuclear weapons first against any nation, non-nuclear or nuclear. We've always refused, and we do refuse today, we all of us, you, we, U.S., other NATO men, refuse to adopt a no first use policy. Instead, we state we are prepared, and indeed we are, to initiate the use of weapons against either a nuclear or a non-nuclear state when we believe it's in our interest to do so. However, during the 40 years that I've been working on issues relating to U.S. and NATO nuclear strategy and to war plans, I have never seen a piece of paper that outlines a plan for initiating the use of nuclear weapons with benefits to the initiator. Never a piece of paper that outlines the benefits to the initiator of using nuclear weapons against either a non-nuclear state or a nuclear state. Against a non-nuclear state, it's militarily unnecessary. We don't need it. We've got conventional weapons to do whatever we want that nuclear weapon to do against a non-nuclear state. It would be militarily unnecessary, morally reprehensible, politically indefensible against a non-nuclear state. Against a nuclear state, it's suicide. During the Cuban Missile Crisis, we had something on the order of 5,500 strategic warheads that we could deliver on the Soviet Union. And we thought they had, it turned out we somewhat overestimated, but we thought they had 350 they could deliver against us. We were deterred from using our 5,500 against them because we were certain that one or two or five or 50 of their 350 would survive. And what responsible leader would subject his nation to 5 or 10 or 50 of these damn things? So, I come back to the point. I have never seen a piece of paper that outlined how a nation possessing nuclear weapons could initiate their use against either a nuclear or a non-nuclear power with benefit. So as I say, the conclusion is clear. We should move to eliminate them. Now, partly because of the increased understanding of how close we came to disaster during the Cuban Missile Crisis, but also because of this growing recognition that the military utilities of these weapons is very limited and that the risk of accidental use or inadvertent use in a crisis is substantial, there's been a revolutionary change in thinking about the role of nuclear forces. And much of this change has occurred in the last 6 or 7 years. Many military leaders and civilian security experts are now prepared to go beyond the Bush-Yeltsin agreements And some go as far as I have to state that the long-term objective should indeed be a return to a non-nuclear world. Many of your British leaders have done that. Lord Mountbatten, for example, before he was killed, publicly stated he would never, when he was British Chief of Defense Staff, he would never have recommended or authorized the use of nuclear weapons. Your Field Marshal Lord Carver, another former British Defense Chief who is alive today, has stated that publicly. General Andrew Goodpaster, who was Eisenhower's military aide and later became Supreme Allied Commander in Europe, has said exactly the same thing. The Bush administration, however, is far from supporting such a view. The administration published not long ago, about 2 months ago, what's known as the Nuclear Posture Review. It was mandated by Congress. And that posture review establishes the broad outline of U.S. nuclear strategy and force levels for the next 10 years and beyond. The review has received very, very little attention from the media in the U.S., and I imagine probably even less attention here in Britain. And I think that's unfortunate because it increases the emphasis to be placed on strategic offensive nuclear weapons. And therefore, I think it deserves a vigorous public debate. On November 13 of last year, President Bush announced he had told President Putin of Russia that the U.S. would reduce operationally deployed nuclear warheads to a level between 1,700 and 2,200. That's down from roughly the 7,000 we have today over the next several years. And that would approximate the total of 1,500 that Putin said Russia would like to move down to. The Nuclear Policy Review, however, presents quite a different picture. It assumes that Bush's stated objective of reducing the strategic offensive missile deployment from the level of some 7,000 down to 1,700 or 2,200 would take the majority of the warheads that are removed from deployment and put them in reserve stocks capable of being redeployed very, very quickly. So there would be a substantial reduction in deployed forces, but not a significant reduction in the overall nuclear capability. Now, the administration's action, I think, is to be welcomed. The very statement that Bush would do something unilaterally to reduce nuclear risk is important, and I credit him with it. But after the reductions, we'd be left with, depending on the number and depending on the year, at a minimum 2,000 nuclear warheads, strategic nuclear warheads, and the Russians with 1,500. And I doubt that if there were a survivor of an exchange of 3,500 warheads, our 2,000 and the Russian 1,500, if there were a survivor, I doubt he could notice any difference in the world from an exchange of our current, whatever, 13,000. So, it's a step forward, but it leaves us with the same risk of destructions that we have today. And the administration is projecting the deployment of that large number of weapons and their associated launch vehicles far into the future. They propose to develop new warheads. They propose to develop new launch vehicles, a new land-based missile, a new sea-based missile, new bomber extending out into 2040. In a very real sense, they're proposing to maintain large numbers of strategic offensive nuclear weapons in perpetuity. Now, if time permitted, I'd want to talk about the potential impact of that policy, assuming I've stated it correctly, on Russia and China, and the impact on those nations of relations with the West, particularly the U.S. Time won't permit that, so I only want to comment on the effects of U.S. policy on the non-proliferation regime. You may remember it's reported that President Kennedy said he expected to have 20 or 30 nations possessing nuclear weapons 10 or 15 years after his presidency. That didn't occur. Today, there are only 8 nations possessing nuclear weapons. The reason it didn't occur was the Non-Proliferation Treaty was negotiated. And that treaty specifically limits the right of nations to possess nuclear warheads. Essentially, these eight are it. No other nation may. No other nation may possess even one. What will happen to that treaty if we say we're different from all of you? We need several thousand of these things in perpetuity. You're not to be allowed to possess one. I think you can guess. You don't have to guess, because a clause of the treaty provides that the other nations will be relieved of their obligations under the treaty if the five declared nuclear powers do not move to eliminate nuclear weapons. And we would be moving in directly the opposite direction. It's a very, very serious risk to the future. It's made more serious by the fact that if the proliferation regime breaks down, there's a high probability fissile materials will fall into the hands of terrorists. Many of you probably know it's very easy to build a nuclear weapon if you have fissile materials. A friend of mine was head of the U.S. Arms Control Agency. He visited South Africa. South Africa showed him the room in which they had built nuclear weapons. It was about as long as this stage. They built seven weapons there, and they said it cost $50 million. I'm speaking now in addition to fissile materials. It cost $50 million, and they used 250 men. We know that bin Laden had two conversations with the chairman of the Pakistani Nuclear Weapons Committee. This is not a danger that is not present. It's not a danger we should live with. We're going to live with it if we continue down the path we're embarked on. So, it need not be. We can take action to reduce these risks I've talked about. The nuclear genie can be put back in the bottle. The primary responsibility for reducing the number of nuclear weapons lies with the U.S. and Russia, particularly with the U.S. But every major nation in the world, yours, Germany, Japan, Israel, France, Norway, all contribute to this risk. All must bear part of the responsibility for extending it in the future. All have failed to do as much as they could to reduce it. If we do act to reduce the nuclear risk, which, as I say, I think is possible, and if we do act to further institutionalize the maintenance of collective security, then the 21st century, while unlikely to be a century of tranquility, need not witness the killing by conflict of another 160 million human beings. Some of you, perhaps most of you, may think my comments are so simplistic, so idealistic as to be quixotic. But as human beings, citizens of great nations, with power to influence events in the world, can we be at peace with ourselves if we strive for less? I think not, and I hope you will agree with me. Now, before we open to your questions, I want to ask Bob Brigham to comment on two points. One, which I was going to do and I've left out because of the pressing of time, and he will cover, is the what I call the institutionalizing of action to reduce and resolve conflict in this globalized age. And the second has to do with the degree to which the U.S. should or should not apply its superior political, economic, and military power unilaterally. Globalization is a subject very much on the minds of many of the young people in the U.S. I presume the same thing's true here. It's a tremendous force in the world, whether you're thinking about it in terms of transmission of financial flows, electronic communications, trade. There's also a globalization of security matters, globalization of political issues. We have not established the political institutions to deal with these. Bob?
Thank you. Thank you, Secretary McNamara. Professor Brigham.
Well, I have the unenviable task of following Secretary McNamara. But I will address the two topics that he outlined, the institutionalization of conflict resolution and the idea that the United States need not act unilaterally in the future. The 1990s saw in the world great problems of conflict, and these problems of conflict brought with us new moral dilemmas, whether to intervene because of human rights violations or not. We saw this in Rwanda. We saw this in the Balkans. We continue to see this in the world today. The problem, as I see it, is that in order to maximize our results on conflict resolution, we will need a multilateral approach, and we will have to use existing institutions, at least in the beginning. And the big problem there is that most of the institutions of international relations on a global scale are Cold War constructs. The United Nations, for example, the five members of the Security Council, five permanent members, those five memberships come as a result of the Cold War. So I think in our post-Cold War world, if we're serious about institutionalizing conflict resolution, the first thing we would have to do is expand the Security Council to reflect more accurately the globe today. The second thing that we would probably have to do is get rid of the permanent veto power of the five standing members and move more to a majority vote. Let me use Rwanda as an example. As most of you no doubt know, Kofi Annan at that time was not the director. He was heading up the peacekeeping efforts in Rwanda, and he could not get a resolution through the United Nations to support action that the United States would then support. And the United States was going to have to support this for to be able to follow through on this. And in the process, in April, beginning in April 1994, in 100 days, a million Rwandans were killed. And they were killed at low-level conflicts, mostly with machetes and knives. And the thinking is, if you could make the United Nations more responsive through implementation of a little-known caveat in Chapter 8, which does allow the United Nations to intervene when human rights violations are present, that then you could move, if you move beyond a veto, a single veto issue, you could move to majority vote, that some of these issues would come up. And when they didn't come up, the United States most certainly has to take more of a lead in these matters. Along those lines, it would be important, I think, as well, to build more regional associations around the globe, in the Pacific, in the Middle East, et cetera, like NATO, that have not only mutual defense pacts, but have in their charters thinking on human rights violations. One thing that Secretary McNamara and I have talked a lot about is about establishing an international mediation system within the United Nations, a subset of the Security or Economic Council. And of course, something that's been in the papers recently that the United States is going down the round track in my mind is the International Criminal Court. As most of you know, President Bush has vowed to unsign the treaty that President Clinton signed, but the Senate never ratified, helping to create the International Criminal Court. This will be the first time in U.S. history that a president has unsigned a treaty. Now, over here, it might not be getting much of a play, but in the United States, this is an enormous controversial issue. We aren't sure what this means to unsign a treaty. I think a majority of the public is baffled by this action. And I know that the Secretary and I completely support the creation of the International Criminal Court. And quite frankly, the reasons why we shouldn't support it, according to the Bush administration, that our leaders and soldiers would be subject to trial by purely political means, I don't think that stands up very much under close scrutiny. All of these measures are controversial. And following Secretary McNamara in his speech, we tend to be more idealistic than realistic on this panel. These would be hard to win support for in the United States, but they are essential, I think, if we're going to avoid the kind of bloodshed, not only of the 20th century, but the last decade of the 20th century gave us a new kind of war, a new kind of conflict that's going to require creative solutions. And these five proposals, I think, are a step in the right direction. Of course, the United States does act unilaterally. We act unilaterally all the time. We go it alone because we think our ideas are just, that we're a good people, and that the world will benefit from our actions. This has a long history in the United States, probably starting with that Puritan John Winthrop, who proclaimed that we were a city upon a hill for all the world to look up to and admire, this bold experiment that everyone would want to emulate. George Washington, in his farewell address, warned of entangling alliances with Europe, and most people have associated that with isolationism, but that really isn't the thrust of it. It's really about Americans having freedom of action. John O'Sullivan, a failed businessman in the 1820s who gave us the term Manifest Destiny, had a messianic vision of American exceptionalism. We were the new chosen people. And of course, the United States Senate rejected Woodrow Wilson's view of a League of Nations, again, preferring instead freedom of action. In all of these cases, the United States has thought its means and its ends just because we are a good and honorable people. That just simply isn't enough anymore in the modern world. The arrogance and parochialism of American foreign policy is problematic on several fronts, one of which the Secretary has already mentioned. Even with our preponderant power, we cannot influence events in the world with our hard power. There is no hard power solution to AIDS in Africa. There is no hard power solution to global warming. There is no hard power solution, perhaps even to some of the internal conflicts that we're seeing in the world. The other problem that we face, of course, is the United States cannot be a superpower on the cheap, and we have tried to do that. Joe Nye, the dean of the Kennedy School at Harvard, has just written a new book on what he calls soft power, and I would expand his definition of soft power. He sees soft power as the economic and cultural and even ideological elements of American society that the rest of the world might want to adopt, and that you have influence in these. I would say that there are a lot of institutional impediments for us to make the use of soft power effective. One is, of course, in our funding strategies and the very structure of the American government. Our foreign aid program is pretty much of a disaster right now. We spend less than 1/10 of 1% of our GNP on foreign aid. Most industrial European nations spend 0.3 of 1%. The goal, of course, is 7/10 of 1%. Of the $10 billion in U.S. foreign aid, almost half of that goes to Israel and Egypt. So our foreign aid budget needs to be revisited. The United States Information Agency, which would have been the institution that would carry out Joe Nye's vision of soft power, has seen its budget since 1980 slashed repeatedly, and it's slashed so much, in fact, that it's now incorporated within the State Department, and it's all of its budgetary requests have to go through that vehicle. It gets its money last. And I don't know how familiar you are with the USIA, but this is all of our soft power and statecraft. This is all of the training for area and languages. This is all of the local libraries and our embassies and other kind of statecraft-oriented things. This is a huge problem. One of the things that happened after September 11th, of course, was the United States had to scramble to find Arabic speakers to help it just translate documents, and then it had to dig even deeper to find people who really had the cultural sophistication to help us out. It's a problem. Our educational system was funded primarily on a Cold War mindset. All of our area study centers come to us through research universities through what we call Title VI grants. Those grants have dried up. I learned some foreign languages as a graduate student, and not one of the fellowships that I went to school on still exists. So even in our soft power, we have funding impediments, I think, to fully utilize this. So if you combine unilateral action with an unwillingness to look at the United Nations and other multilateral organizations in a more constructive way, we're headed for disaster internationally, and the crisis that we face are going to be more severe and more complex because the ideological rivalry isn't as intense and isn't as driving as some of these more subtle and culturally sophisticated ideas. Add to that nuclear weapons, and we are in a fix that needs our attention, and it needs our attention now. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Bob. We have about 7 or 8 minutes for questions. I'll start by asking the first one of the Secretary, and then some of you get ready to ask questions. Secretary McNamara, I was wondering, with regard to the present situation in the Middle East. Now, it was quite clear from what you said in your talk that you expect the United States to play a major role in finding some kind of peace solution within that region. What do you think the United States can do that it's not doing at the moment in order to put pressure on Israel to halt the offensive in the occupied areas and to get some kind of negotiation going?
Well, let me say, I think this is one of these cases where there should be no unilateral action, unilateral imposition of power. And I think one of the participants in decisions relating to power in the Middle East or solutions should be Britain. And I'm very, very grateful indeed to Prime Minister Blair for the attention he's given to this problem. And he has had an influence. There's no question in my mind about it, and I hope he'll continue to be. Now, you ask about the solution to the Middle East. Well, number one, I should tell you I'm very pro-Israel. And number two, I have been for 40 years. But I also want to tell you something I bet there aren't two people in this room know. We have security treaties with Japan, with South Korea, you name it, all over the world. We have never had, we do not have today, a security treaty with Israel. And at critical moments of time, particularly in June 67, during the Six-Day War, when I was secretary, it was during a period when the hotline was used for the first time, and one of the messages running back and forth between Kosygin and Johnson in relation to this conflict in the Middle East, Six-Day War, was, if you want war, you're going to get it, meaning war with the Soviet Union because of the position we were taking with respect to Israel. Now, part of that came about because we did not then have a security treaty with Israel. In any event, we don't have one today. Now, what to do in this situation? See, there's only one answer. You've got to have two independent states, Palestine and Israel. And you've got to have a Palestine state. And you can't have an independent Palestine state if you've got 200,000 Israelis on the soil, this very limited soil of Palestine in the West Bank. And their settlements are there. Well, you know, thank you for clapping, but what the hell are you going to do about it? Or what should we do? What should we do about it? This is the problem. Maybe it's not your problem, it's our problem. But I don't think, and I may be wrong, and perhaps I shouldn't be speaking as directly on this as I am, but it's a problem I've lived with for 40 years, literally, concerned about Israel's security, knowing we had no security guaranteed. One of the reasons we didn't have a security guarantee, in addition to the fact that I'm not at all sure we could have ever gotten one through our Senate during that 40-year period, when Dean Rusk and I went up to the Senate in the face of this message from Khrushchev, in effect, you'll have war if you behave the way you are, the Senator Jack Javits, a Jewish senator from New York, and Muskie, a senior Democratic senator, Javits was Republican, asked Dean Rusk and me to come up and meet with the senior senators at the time. We met with 45 or 50 of them. We could not have gotten a security treaty through the Senate at that time. Now, Israel knows that. And the degree to which the U.S. would support Israel in a critical point has never been entirely clear. In any event, in this particular situation, I don't think there's any solution to the conflict between Palestine and Israel, and more generally, between Israel and the Arab world, or in a very real sense, between the U.S. and the Arab world, other than one which establishes two independent states, essentially in accordance with the boundaries before the June 67 war. There was a United Nations resolution that President Johnson and I, Dean Rusk, helped craft. It's known as UN Resolution 242. I see an Arab ambassador in front of me, and you will know that resolution. I almost memorized it, and I'm sure you have. And it establishes boundaries for Israel, and they're not within those boundaries. And that's a problem. It's a problem for them. It's not going to be easy for Israel to get back into those boundaries. And it's a problem for the U.S. if the U.S. is going to put pressure on them. I see no solution that does not involve that.
Thank you very much. Up on the gallery, second from front, yeah?
Before my question, I just wanted to actually point out, too, that unless there was another incident in Afghanistan, the four troops that were killed were actually Canadian troops. But my question, to do with the foreign policy in the 21st century, is how do you, Secretary McNamara, feel that missile defense may or may not fit into that? Do you see that as a good or a negative?
If time had permitted, I'd like to have talked about missile defense. I'm very biased on the subject. In November 1966, I persuaded President Johnson to initiate the action that led 6 years later, 1972, to the ABM Treaty, Anti-Ballistic Missile Defense Treaty, which I think is absolutely fundamental to maintaining strategic stability between potential adversaries with large numbers of nuclear weapons, that is to say Russia and the U.S. I think it's unfortunate that the U.S. is moving as it is toward deployment of missile defense, but I do believe that President Bush has done a very good job in working with the Russians to reduce their fear of the consequences of that. China has some real problems. We should all learn from China. I doubt that you understand that China has been facing several thousand potential U.S. weapons directed against it for 40 years. And for the last 20 or 25 years, they've thought, and I think they're correct, that they had a capability of deterring the U.S. from ever launching those by maintaining 20 intercontinental ballistic missiles capable of launching nuclear warheads on the U.S. 20 deterred the U.S. from launching whatever we had, several thousand. At one point, President Kennedy said, one on us is enough. I was in the room on a Sunday. It would have been the 21st of October in the family quarters of the White House, and he had his senior military and civilian advisors there, including the fighter commander, General Sweeney. And Sweeney was to be in command of the U.S. air attacks on Cuba were they ever to be launched. And at one point, Kennedy turned to Sweeney and said, General, can you take those Soviet missiles out of Cuba? Can you destroy them with your attack? As I said, the first day's air attack was to be 1,080 sorties. And there were only, at the time, we thought there were 28 missile sites. And Sweeney, I could have kissed him. He said, Mr. President, we had the finest Air Force in the world. We trained to do exactly that. Nobody can do it better, but can I guarantee to get them all? No, there might be one, two, or five left. Now, what leader would have attacked, knowing that there might be one, two, or five nuclear warheads, which on average would have been 10, 20, 30 times the kill capability of the Hiroshima bomb? What military, political leader would expose his society to that? Kennedy wouldn't and didn't. That's the problem. And missile defense carries the risk of reducing the stability that is absolutely essential between potential adversaries possessing nuclear weapons. Without that stability, there's a great pressure to and a risk of preemption in moments of crisis. That's what the Missile Defense Treaty was designed to ensure, stability in moments of crisis, and it has for 30-odd years.
Take a quick final question over there, the gray shirt.
Yeah. I'm sorry.
Thank you. I have a question regarding U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East. Basically, I think the U.S. has an important part to play as a mediator, but to be able to play that important part, it has to be unbiased. However, I just feel that there seems to be an incredible lot of bias towards Israel. If you take two cases, the attack on the
U.S. Sorry, you have to make this very, very short.
Yeah, okay. Well, basically, as Mr. McNamara probably knows, the attack on the USS Cole, and the response to that was very different to the attack on the USS Liberty in June 1967.
Well, I'm not sure you're right. I was secretary at the time of the attack on the, I was secretary at the time of the attack on the Liberty, and I don't recall the difference you're talking about. The Liberty is a very controversial issue. People have said that U.S. aircraft took off to respond to the attack on the Liberty, and I turned them back. Well, they're wrong on two counts. A, they didn't take off, and B, I didn't turn them back. But C, there was no response. And to this day, I'm severely criticized as a result. Speak now of the Liberty.
Thank you very much, Secretary McNamara. Professor Brigham.
Thank you very much.